pleasure to introduce Clancy I.
Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immersloth, and I'm an alcoholic. And I only know one way to respond to such an introduction as that. You just kind of look at the leader with the best of your ability and say, "Oh, shit, Ralph." I'm glad to be here, however, safe and sane and sober, because I didn't used to be, obviously, and it's conceivable that I may not be again someday, that I may not be safe and sane and sober, because this organization is made up of a percentage of people, and nobody knows who they are, who will die drunk. And some of them are old-timers now, and some of them are newcomers now, and some of them are just getting their second wind now. There's a lot of people in our organization who are going to die drunk, and a lot of people are going to be out there drinking again, and maybe get sober again. And no one of us know who they will be. We make book on others, but we don't have the ability to make book on ourselves sometimes. And I am glad that today I am safe and sane and sober. As I always like to, sounds like a very negative way to open a talk, perhaps, but I always try to say something to that effect. So I remember why I continue to be a participating, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. This morning at about 2 o'clock, I was walking around the park across the street from my house with a man who used to be safe and sane and sober, just got released from the psych ward in a hospital following an overdose of narcotics. And he used to be the secretary of my home group. Right after I was the secretary, then he was the secretary. And he outgrew the petty therapeutics of AA, as I have started to do a number of times. And he very nearly died from it. And now, in the last couple of days, he's lost his business. And he's very close to losing his family. And he's very close to being at the end of the road. And I stop and think, he was among the most alert and enthusiastic members of Alcoholics Anonymous I knew at one time. And instead, he and I were walking around the park while I tried to just get him tired enough so he could get to sleep so his wife could drive him home. And these are good reminders for me. Every once in a while, I go to a funeral of someone who I used to know, used to be an enthusiastic, participating member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who one day or another found it necessary to induce some chemical into their system to handle the rigors of living after you have stopped being a participating member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have seen this happen to people who've been sober a lot longer than I've been sober today. Ralph mentioned Miami Beach. That was a very touching memory I had down there from that. I met a woman down there who was 29 years sober the day of the convention opened on Friday, and she felt very sad because she'd been coming to these conventions and meeting her sponsor, who came from Cleveland every 5 years, and talking to him once a year on the phone. And he was 33 years sober, and he wouldn't make it this year because he got drunk last week. One of the oldest timers in AA, you know. And that's kind of shocking, because when you're maybe like me, and maybe like some of you, and you're not really basically a good person to begin with, you know, unless the good ones are gone, what chance have we got? When I talked to her, and I talked to some of the people from Cleveland whom I knew, and I understood it, he hadn't been to a meeting in 3 years either, because he had become a wise elder statesman, an AA who knew it so well he no longer had to do it. And that's how apparently old timers get drunk, some of them. I've seen a lot of people who helped me get sober. A man who was my sponsor and saved my life died drunk. And he was sober longer than I'm sober now. We're about the same length of time now. It seemed like an incredible period of time then, but it doesn't seem so long now. Another and the other paradox of this program, which is one of the most peculiar paradoxes that I know in Alcoholics Anonymous, are these two apparently conflicting facts. One, they say this is a spiritual program. Now, there may be some quibblings about that at the neighborhood discussion meetings about what spiritual means or how many angels can sit on the head of a needle. But I think anyone that's been sober any length of time would accept the fact however you may describe a non-material thing and call it spiritual, whatever your concept of spirituality is, Alcoholics Anonymous truly is a spiritual program. Something has to happen on a non-material basis within you, or else you're not going to stay sober. It may take a long time to happen and may not happen very obviously, but something happens. Now, I think everyone would agree this is a spiritual program. But the paradox of this program is, if you get spiritual enough, you're liable to get drunk. Sometimes. Because some people come here and become so spiritual, they grow right through AA. They come out the other side. And AA becomes too vulgar for them. They said hell at the meeting last week. Now, I'll tell you, there's a phrase, and I've watched this happen to a number of people that I admire and love. And that's why I want to remember it. But you can get talking about God so well that you forget to act like it. And the phrase that always sends a shiver down my back is when I hear people say, I don't get to meetings anymore now. I walk alone with God. Now that's very nice. Who's going to argue with that? Except if you notice such people long enough, if they be alcoholic, apparently one day God always leans over and says, why don't you have a beer, kid? Yeah. I don't really suspect God ever does that, but it would give the illusion. Because I think that if they be obsessive as I am, and I suspect a number of people in this organization are obsessive the way I am, because I read in the book and other people are the way I am, I have a tendency, if I don't watch myself, I have a tendency to confuse God's will with my will. If I think so, God must have sent it to me. Yes. Some years ago, when I was new in AA, I used to get at one time or another, I used to get direct messages from God. And you can't knock that. And I was pleased with them because they, in retrospect, as I look back, I must say they're all signed God, but they're written in my handwriting. Yeah. I used to get messages from God that would say things like, you're right, kid. He is a son of a bitch. Punch him. I will be done, Father. I suspect that there may be people who are not like me in this organization, who are much advanced of me, but I also have a tendency to feel that I do not ever want to pay such outstanding lip service to the spiritual aspect of AA that I forget to take the actions that keep people sober. Because in our book, there's a kind of specifically says that it doesn't say spiritual growth is the magic word. It doesn't say love is the magic word. It doesn't say understanding is the magic word. It says action is the magic word. And knowing all about it and not doing it is not worth a pitcher of warm spit. It just isn't. And I think that's what people like me have to guard against. Because I've been sober a while now, and I've got a pretty good track record behind me. And I've done the things, and I've started meetings, and I've sponsored a lot of people. And I travel around, and sometimes I just sit in my chair and wait for an aura to form around me. Yeah. Suffer the newcomers to come unto me. Let them touch my cloak and go forth. If you get believing your own BS in that, you're in trouble, I'll tell you. You may know you're wonderful, but nobody else does. Or if they do know it, they forget it soon. I didn't always feel this strongly about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because as I said, I used to drink, and I suffered from one of the worst things a drinker can suffer from. I suffered from being a non-alcoholic drinker. Now that's really a bad one, you know. You alcoholics, it's easy for you. You stop drinking and you're well, for Christ's sake. But what if you're a non-alcoholic drinker? What if you are one of those and it becomes obvious that your problem really isn't drinking? Then you got trouble. Because you got to disguise what your real problem is. Your real problem is, my real problem is, there's something wrong with my, as they heard a guy say one night, my front porch light isn't on all the time. And it's more obvious when I'm sober than when I'm drinking. I went to my first AA meeting in 1949 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I was taken out of a jail cell where I was being held through a series of misunderstandings, briefly. Just young man's pranks at that time. And I went to AA for a while, and I thought it was very nice. I was a little appalled to be in the room with these old foofs. You know, terrible. Town drunks in a small town, you know who the town drunks are. And I hung around for a while, and they talked about how much alcohol had hurt them. Now, why would they talk like that in Wisconsin? I don't know why I gave them a southern accent. They didn't say it in a southern accent. They said alcohol hurt them. And I later was in Texas and heard the same thing, and the accents get mixed up. And I realized that they were doing a wonderful work, but I wasn't like them. I'm not a burned-out old drunk. I'm a young, sharp, maybe the hippest thing in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, for all I know. That's the biggest city for 100 miles around. I'll tell you, I spoke at an Al-Anon meeting with my little bride Thursday night of this week, and I heard her say something that had to make me laugh, but it was true. She said she grew up on a farm in Wisconsin, she was saying, and she said all her life her ambition was to go to the city and marry a city boy, and finally her dream came true. She married a boy from the biggest city around there, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, you know. And that's just the way I felt towards the people in the country. I feel, you know, man, you don't know what it's like here on the bricks up in the big city. I go back there now, and that town has really shrunk. I was there Mother's Day, and you can drive across town in 7 minutes, and it just doesn't seem right somehow. There's just something wrong. But I'm not like these people. And I went out and drank for a while. And I got into some trouble through a series of misunderstandings. And I went back to AA again. And I went for a while, and I wasn't like these people. And I went to AA for a while and left, drank for a while, went to a different city, got a job, and got some misunderstandings. And I went to AA for a while. And when I got feeling better, I wasn't like them people in that city either. Then I left again, and I went to a different city, and by this time I had a wife and growing family, and every time I'd go into a city, I'd go in as the kind of the point man and bring them in after I was established. And I went to AA in all these cities and with all these things, and it never changed, because it became apparent to me in maybe my second year in and out of AA, and it became more apparent as the years went by, I am one of those people, I'm not an alcoholic. I am not really an alcoholic, and I could prove it at every time I heard an AA speaker, it seemed like to me, or discussion meetings, because the phrase I always heard was, if you're really an alcoholic, your problem is alcohol. And I always knew my problem was not really alcohol. It looked like it was alcohol when I got drunk, But it wasn't really alcohol, because it just wasn't. Because those people had an entirely different history. I remember one of the lines that always sticks in my mind from all the years I've been around AA. Things like, people used to tell me, God, when you're sober, Clyde, you're such a wonderful guy. But when you drink, you're so terrible, huh? I thought, I have never heard anybody tell me that ever. I've never heard anybody tell me I was wonderful sober. Because I get tense and irritable when I get sober. And nervous. And people say things to me like, you're such a pain in the ass when you're on the wagon. You really are. Why don't you have a couple drinks and relax? Then after you have a few drinks, they say, why don't you go on the wagon again? Just, yeah. And this went on for years. I kept moving, trying to find a city where I would blend into my environment. About a month and a half ago, I went to a play down in the Music Center in Los Angeles, and I saw a play I hadn't seen since 1948 called A Streetcar Named Desire, which you may be familiar with. But there's a very touching scene at the end of that. This poor old crazy lady is being taken away to the mental hospital or some sort, and she's really had a bad run, and she is just out of it. And she says to the doctor, Doctor, will you be kind to me? He said, of course we will, Miss Dubois. Of course we will. She says, I hope so, because I've always had to depend upon the kindness of strangers. And I felt that way of that story of my life. I kept hitting them cities. Where am I going to find the kind strangers? Where am I going to fit in? Where am I going to do something? Because if I could fit in and get rid of some of these emotional problems, I wouldn't drink. Because drinking was not my problem. I don't want to, you know. I drink, and the reason I know drinking isn't my problem is because drinking is the closest thing I ever found is an answer to my problem. The problem, what I identify that as, varies from time to time. But I know it isn't that. And this went on year after year after year. You know, you hear a lot of conversations about high-bottom and low-bottom drunks and which is more difficult to overcome and which is easier. I have been a high-bottom drunk and I've been a low-bottom drunk. And they both are rotten. They both are rotten. I started off as a moderately high-bottom drunk and I wound up as a low-bottom drunk selling my blood in the Skid Row blood bank. And there's an advantage and a disadvantage to each. But the advantage, of course, of being a high-bottom drunk, or still have something going for when you get to AA, is that it certainly is physically more convenient, for instance, to have a place to sleep. And when you are sick, it's nice to have a place to go where somebody at least simulates interest. And it's nice to... You can call a doctor when you feel bad, and you can go to a hospital, perhaps, and you don't have to be cold. Just because the weather outside is cold, you don't have to be cold yourself. Now, that's an advantage. The corresponding disadvantage, of course, to being a low-bottom drunk is that when it's cold outside and you're outside, you're cold. And when you're sick, you're sick. And nobody really cares. And it really is physically terribly uncomfortable sometimes. And it truly is a 24-hour-a-day existence. They talk about the 24-hour-a-day program. When you're a low-bottom drunk, you get to the 24-hour-a-day program just as surely as if you're the most wonderful AA that ever lived. The two extremes reach the 24-hour-a-day program. All we're in between, we aim for it. But you just, how am I going to make it through today? And sometimes it's a 20-minute program. How am I going to get through 20 minutes? How am I going to do for the next hour? Just make it till noon, yeah. Just survive. It's brute survival. There's an advantage and disadvantage to it the other way around, you know, in the psychological ring. There is a grave disadvantage in being a high-bottom drunk, and that is, you still got to pretend everything is all right. And that's a tough one. And you just can't say, oh, Jesus When people say, how are you? You say, fine. And there may be an eagle fluttering in your tummy somewhere, but it's fine. Everything's all right. Leave me alone. I'm making a living. When you're a low-bottom drunk, the advantage is you don't have to pretend anymore. You can be just what you know you are. Nothing. And it's I'll tell you, it's a great... The suicide rate is considerably higher among high-bottom drunks than among low-bottom drunks. Because it's easier to take the physical inconvenience and the psychological relaxation rather than take the physical comfort and the psychological terrible ripping conflict of watching it go and being unable to stop it. But they're both rotten. When you're standing in line, waiting outside of the midnight mission, in a skid row somewhere, you never have to worry people coming up and saying, how are things at the office? You know. Heard from your mother lately? Mm-hmm. Just doesn't come up. But over the period of years, I knew one thing. I knew that I should never have come around that stinking AA. I used to think about this. Because when I came to AA, I had been in jail 3 times. And I'd been once voluntary in a veterans hospital after the Second World War, where I turned in for nervousness. Well, I want to explain that. A lot of people laugh at that today, but you don't remember that there used to be a Second World War, and you just don't take people who are trained to kill and be ruthless killers and return to civilian life without any adjustment period. And I used to think about that, lying in bed at night. I remember such things as walking out at the end of the pier at Great Lakes, Illinois, with my wooden rifle doing my guard duty, and looking up Lake Michigan and knowing that if the Japanese fleet came down Lake Michigan, I was what stood between Wisconsin and Lake Michigan. Now, you just don't go back to civilian life from an experience like that without... I usually don't like to talk about being a war hero, but... But I'd been in the veterans hospital just Christmas vacation, you know, from college. I went to college in the GI Bill because it was an easier, softer way than anything else I had. And after I came to AA, they said, son, your life will change if you come to these meetings. And I went to those meetings and my life did change. I went to jail 32 times. And I went into 2 city hospitals, 1 county hospital, and was finally committed to spend the rest of my life in the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas. AA changed my life. It really made it wonderful, I'll tell you. And all that time, I always knew that I was not really an alcoholic, because alcohol was not really my problem. I eventually lost my family and 4 little daughters, and I lost my occupation. Eventually lost my front teeth one day in the Phoenix tank. We have a trustee from Phoenix now, the sneak. But in the Phoenix tank, a guy just arbitrarily came by and kicked my teeth up. Now, what kind of treatment is that to tourists? And I was down to 109 pounds eventually. And I'm 178 now, and I'm not really fat, so you can imagine 69 pounds off me. I really was not what you'd call bulky. And I was dying on the streets. I was on the lam from Texas. And I'm sure, as our leader has heard me say before, I was the only way now is in Phoenix or Los Angeles, because I was trying to get to Seattle. And I didn't want to be in Seattle because of Seattle, but I wanted to be in Seattle because it was a long way from Texas, and I was wanted in Texas to go back to the nut house. And I I couldn't get to Seattle. I had a vision I'd get a job in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and start a new life, and I never could get there. And I had to get out of Texas because in Texas I was hot. And it was a funny thing that I wasn't always hot in Texas. I could tell you my whole story in just about 2 minutes, really. Of just how would this happen? Because all my life I've been a 50-yard dash man. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But if they paid off on the 50-yard dash, I'd be president of the world. Because I am just great at the 50-yard dash. And just start off and really crack and run over. Then one day, screw it. You know, and the race isn't over. You know, and you never break any tapes. And the rest of them are running the marathon, and you've led by 40 yards at the end of 50, but at 55, they're all by you because you're sitting down wondering what next. All my life, I've been a 50-yard dash man. Start, stop, start, stop, start, stop, start, stop. But in 1954, winter of 1954, I hitchhiked into San Francisco. The reason I was in San Francisco is because I just left an advertising agency in the Midwest because I'd just done something so bad that I felt so guilty. In my family, when I did guilty, I ran away from home again and again. But I did, oh, God, I felt bad because I had just, in my opinion, caused my best friend to commit suicide. And I felt I wanted to fly. I hitchhiked in a blizzard across the central United States. And I got to San Francisco and I ran across a guy I knew there. And he and I had been in the Navy together. And I played the piano up and down Geary Street, and he sang, and we hustled tourists and stole money and abused old folks. I never thought I was going to be, you know, if I thought I was going to live this old myself, I'd have treated myself better. But that town got hot for us, so we had to get out of there, and it was about time for me to make my new start. So he says, have you ever been in Texas? And I said, no. He says, I got some friends in El Paso. Let's go to El Paso. We hitchhiked to El Paso and got in there in the spring of late winter of 1954-55, and I got it started over. New town, new place. I got a job in the El Paso Times, and shortly thereafter, I was working in a firm called Mithoff. Got my family down from the Midwest, got a home in El Paso. By May of 1956, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas at El Paso, then called Texas Western, at night, in the daytime, working in an advertising agency, directing the El Paso Civic Theater and their summer project. And I was just something. And 3 months later, I was in the Texas Nut House. Yeah. Story of my life. Just bad breaks. Bad breaks. And I don't mind saying that I was not in the Texas Nut House for being an alcoholic. I wasn't ever put away for being an alcoholic. That also helps you know you're not an alcoholic. Nothing on my commitment paper said alcoholic. It said things like schizophrenic and depressive and paranoid tendencies. And the other little significant fact, I had successfully committed suicide, and the man next door got my heart started in time for me to be put in the insane asylum. Big deal. My wife mentioned something the other night that I don't ever remember, and I guess it must be true because she said it in Al-Anon meeting. It's got to be true. But it's something I never remember happening, and I had never heard about it from the day it happened till now. She said in late 56, when I was in that psycho ward being examined, I escaped from the psycho ward. Now, I remember escaping from the nut house, but I remember escaping from the psycho ward. She said, they looked all over for me. I was gone only a minute, and they couldn't find me. And I just disappeared in thin air down an alley. And they had just given up. They were coming back in the hospital. One of those goofy attendants aimlessly lifted the top of a garbage can. Who would think that some goof would look in a garbage can? But they brought me back, and they put me in the nut house. And I was there till I got well. I was supposed to stay there till I got well, which means that I could not be joining you today for this meeting. And I felt, this is terrible. They got no business holding me here. They got no business holding me here. I just forgot that a month before I was dead. And here all of a sudden I was being abused again. So I escaped. I mentioned that a number of times, but I escaped from the Texas State. They said it's an escape-proof institution, and I escaped from it because I'm smarter than any big old redneck Texas attendant. That's all. Nothing personal, just the facts. I got found a way through a window and through a piece of bulletproof glass, apparently, they said, and down a corridor and through a door and through another corridor and through a door and across the yard and over the fence. And I escaped, and it wasn't until after I escaped that I realized it truly is an escape-proof institution, but you don't know it till after you escape. Because West Texas is just like the country east of Sparks. You get over that last fence, and they can see you running for 3 days than it ever is. And you feel like such a boob in your white bathrobe, just. And it's just a matter of time till those field glasses pick you up. And, well, there goes that little Yankee son of a bitch now. And they snatched me back and transferred me to the electroshock ward. And in the next couple of months, I guess I had 48 electroshock treatments, which was the maximum they could give you. And they don't ever give you electric shock treatments for escaping or for being hostile, because it is not a punishment. It's just that if you escape, it indicates you're disturbed. And if you're disturbed, you get shock treatments. So, you know, it looks better on your record. It feels the same. I go down there now every year. I speak in that hospital every year at my own expense. I'm the only returning graduate, but it's the only campus where they're glad to see me come back. I always speak in that same ward, and I look at a chair sitting in the same place, and I think, sitting in that chair in 1957, six, trying to think, what's my name? What's my name? Because after you get a lot of shock treatments, you don't know your name. You don't know anything. You don't know what you're doing there, where you came from. I've often thought it was a bad break in timing. All my life, my timing has been off, kind of. Now, stop and think about it. In 1966, a guy got, four shock treatments and went on to become a candidate for the presidency of the United States. In 1956, I got 48 shock treatments. And if I had my rights, I could now be running for higher power. Yeah, just something. It never works out for me. But I was thinking about something today, and I want to say this just exactly right, so nobody misunderstands me in the slightest. But when I came off those shock treatments, I was very frightened. And I wanted to get out of there. It's funny to talk about it. It wasn't funny to be there because... Well, let me say, interject one thing. No matter what you say in an AA talk, it really doesn't carry the implication of being there ever to anybody because of one thing. The listeners always know that no matter what you say, it's going to turn out all right. Eventually, you're going to say, and then it all got better. But when you're living through it, you don't know it. It don't seem like it's gonna. You know, I've often thought AA talks would be much more realistic. Couldn't be done, but wouldn't you listen more closely if every once in a while a speaker would say, and then it turned out, friends, just couldn't make it. Because that's really the way it is in the real world out there, you know. We forget there's just successes here, you know. We don't have a minority report much from the podium. But I had to get out of there, and I was afraid. And I became broke. First time in my life, I ever kowtowed completely. They wanted something, I gave it to them. I became a snitch in my ward. I did anything. And I didn't know why I was doing it, but I know I was afraid. And I started a hospital newspaper, which is still running.
I directed a little Christmas pageant, which, about a second grade level, so all the student body could really enjoy it. And the hardest problem it was for the old director to... We had a very highly segregated hospital then. There was no mixture of sexes, men and women. The only time they got together was at Christmas. But and in these rehearsals, and it was just... It sounds terrible, but it's true. The only... My big problem was keeping the wise men off the Virgin Mary till the show. It just... Boom. You get back down there, Lamar Jean. Was good, but I did everything I could do to get out of there, and I got up to the minimum security reward, but I couldn't get out because of my emotions. No matter how hard I determined to put on a drive of being level and well, sooner or later something would irritate me and I'd react, and then they'd say, oh, there he is again. And I just realized it was going to be a lifetime project ever getting up. By this time most of my memory had came back. And they had just built a hospital ward, a new ward at the end of Ward 9. And it was something called an alcoholic ward, one of the first alcoholic wards in Texas in their state hospital system. And they said they had AA there. And by that time I remembered, AA. I've been in and out of AA for 7 years. If I can arrange to get next to them boobs, I'll hustle them right out of their wits, because I can talk AA. And I waited till the guy, Mr. Les Ross, he finally was coming through our ward one day, and I said, Mr. Ross, my name is Clancy Immisland, and I'm here on a suicide commitment from El Paso. And I'm not allowed to go into the alcoholic ward, but I was wondering, do you have some literature I could read, perhaps? I understand you have an answer to a drinking problem, and the only reason I wanted to die was because I'd lost control of my drinking. Do you have any sort of a program or any... thing I could do to find at least some concept in a, perhaps even to return to God, to find something to, his old eyes just went, he had never seen a sincere newcomer before that day. He said, you wait right here, I'll be back. And I didn't hear from him for 3 days. In 3 days, I was given a little sheet of paper that allowed me to attend AA meetings at least twice a day in the AA ward. Now, what I didn't know until I was talking to a fellow, and I hear talking about a man named Shelby Parnell today, a friend of ours in Texas, who's now the counselor at that hospital. But he was telling me later that I was the test case in the state of Texas whether or not psychiatric commitments should be allowed to go to AA meetings, because they never had been or never were supposed to be. And they picked the right man because I was the best one they ever had go, I'll tell you. Because I reacted right. And I went over there and I went to them meetings. I just... Tell us some more about the program, Mr. Ross. Now, everybody else in there were committed by their families or courts for 30 days, you know. You have to go to Big Spring and go to the alcoholic ward and be... And they just hated being there. Nobody was there voluntarily. Just hated it. And so they were just dreadful. They were sincere. They were honest, as I really felt. But they were dreadful. Old Mr. Ross would, like, give us a lecture for an hour. He'd say, and then, now these are the 12 steps. You'd go through the steps for an hour and a half. Now, no group of involuntarily committed people want to hear about them goddamn steps for an hour and a half, ever. Hard enough to play cards for 30 days without listening to them steps, you know. And you get all done and say, are there any questions, boys? But I knew better. They didn't, but they didn't know I didn't tell them I'd ever been around AA. Mr. Ross, perhaps you could tell us some more about the relief to be found in the fourth and fifth steps when we, as you say, take an inventory and get some of this garbage out of our system for the first time and find some freedom. He'd smile and say, yes, Clancy. And everybody else in the room would say, Jesus Christ. But I wasn't trying to impress them. And in a couple months, I was secretary of that group. And a couple more months, I was being taken out of the institution to give talks to groups of alcoholics around, explaining to them how they should practice AA. And I gave wonderful talks. Talked about God a lot. Talked about the new life I'd found. Talked about wonderful things. Sometimes I just momentarily believed it, you know, because I was young. I really did. I remember give little talks like, friends, I'm here tonight on behalf of my fellow patients at Big Spring State Hospital to thank you for the wonderful work you have done in bringing a hope and a recovery program to us that has enabled us to change our path in the vast desert of alcoholism and start to at least find the direction of the green hills of sobriety. I have abused my family, and I have abused my loved ones. But through the kindness you have shown, I begin to see a glimmer of light that enables me to understand that God in his infinite mercy, together with these 12 steps of recovery, will enable me to perhaps find a meaning in my life. Just on and on and on. Old ladies would cry. Isn't that lovely, Margaret? And I always wind up with a little shot like, I know you must be tired sometimes and wonder, is it worthwhile driving 40 miles over to the state hospital to those people who don't seem to be receptive? But you must remember, behind our facades, we are sensitive like you. And although we don't show it, we are grateful to you. And we invoke the blessings of an almighty God on you. And please help us some more. Thank you. Now, you can laugh at that, but that got me out of the Texas Nut House. And back to social drinking, where I belong. I gave wonderful talks. Just passing and parenthetically, even if you get to believe in AA in an institution, one thing that's so rarely mentioned, I took the liberty of presuming to go up to our speaker this morning, who I believe was a sincere, earnest young woman, but I told her something that which is the microcosm of all I know about AA institutions. I go to institutions every month. I've been going to institutions every month for years, and I sponsor people when they come up. But it's this. Remember, you can get to know so much about AA in the institution that you feel that you already know it when you hit the street and you'll die. Because the one thing people in institutions forget, they get thinking that the institution is their problem. And the institution is not their problem. The institution did not put them in the institution. It's because they failed outside the institution to mesh into life. And everybody that's in institution thinks, when I get out next time, it'll be all right. But it won't. You're going back to the cause of your trouble. And that's why so many people come out of institutions and fall and get drunk. Because they think, I know all about AA, I got to the institution, and now I'm back in freedom. And I'll tell you something, anybody that's been locked up much, you will discover in retrospect the best freedom you'll ever have is in the institution, because there at least you know what's expected of you. When you're out in the world with no way to go, that isn't freedom. That's death and transfiguration. That's why people fall. When I explained to that young lady this morning, I said, I hope that you will remember what you said when you get out, and for God's sakes, start with a premise that you now have learned in AA how to live comfortably in an institution. And when you get out, the big job will come. How to live comfortably outside of an institution. Because that's much tougher than learning to live comfortably in an institution, I'll guarantee you. But I got out of there, and it went on and on. My family left me. Everything went. Finally, I got out of there. And I was still signed out to my wife. So when she left me, I had to flee Texas. Because all she ever had to do from then on was pick up the phone, and I was gone. And that makes it tough to live with a woman you don't like. To keep smiling. Every time she goes by that phone, there's a little shiver because there's no hearing anymore. There's no trial. It makes for a little tension around the house. And I left. They left me, and I determined to go to Seattle. And I got to El Paso, and I looked up one of my old sponsors. I'd hustled there, and he wouldn't give me any money. And I cursed and denounced him, and was in the Phoenix jail that night. I mean, the Juarez jail. A couple days later, I was in the Phoenix jail. I got my front teeth kicked out, and I lost my clothes. And I hustled an old lady in the AA club there for some money to get out of town. She didn't know. I give her the same kind of talk I ever give old Mr. Ross. Yeah. And, let me help you. I've only got $2 or $3, son. As she was so easy, I almost sent her home for more. But I got out of that town, and I got into Los Angeles, and I got stuck. Because Los Angeles is a bad town. In one respect, you can't walk out of that goddamn town. You got to make a score to get to the city limits, you know. Just no way to... So I went to the AA club called the 6300 Club. And I hung around there, and there was some misunderstandings about some money on the counter of the coffee bar. And I was banned out of the AA club. There are people present in this room who remember that. So I went down, hung around the beach for a while, a club called the Tender Loving Care Club. The ex-general manager of that club is in this room tonight. It was started by an AA member for alcoholics and a couple of narcotics addicts. And eventually, his autocratic ways, he wanted to make a few dollars, and he wanted to run it without traditions, and AA Central Office kept sending him things, you can't run installations this way. So he threw all the AAs out and all the AA books and all the alcoholics out. He had never had any narcotic problem, but he kept helping narcotics because at least they didn't have any organization to write him letters. And he changed the name of the group to Synanon and made $1 million. I often think, I was just telling my friend today when we were having a cup of coffee, if we'd have stuck with old Chuck, we could have been something today. We might have had one of the biggest coffins in the cemetery. But I left down there and I went back to the... Couldn't get in the AA club, so I went back downtown. I slept in all-night theaters and I sold blood and I stole and I peddled handbills and I did it, you know. I remember standing in line outside of that blood bank on East 4th Street in Skid Row waiting to sell a pint of blood for $4 and thinking, God, how did I ever get here? I never meant to start off like this. I wish it hadn't happened. And the sad thing is, I knew exactly why I was there. Because in my better days, I had spent several $1,000s for an intense psychoanalysis. And I found out why I was the way I was. But it didn't make it any more comfortable. And I was in bad shape, and I was dying on the street. Now, you would think if you knew what was wrong with you, it would help. But I knew what was wrong with me, and I'd explain it to anybody. For instance, now, a lot of people in AA badmouth psychiatrists. They put them down. I don't badmouth psychiatrists, because what I went to that psychiatrist for, I got. I went there to feel better and to find out what was wrong with me. And as he pointed out what was wrong with me little by little, I felt better every time I found out something, because it enabled me to get some perspective, such as, I said I was in the Navy at the end of the World War, too. But before that, at 15, I was overseas. Because when I was 15, I had a great lust for adventure, and I lived in this little town in Wisconsin. I wanted to see what was out there. And after my doctor pointed out to me years later that had left a great trauma, because at 15, I left the high school, and early 1943 and hitchhiked to San Francisco and lied my age and was on an NMU maritime ship on the top of a load of torpedo warheads going to the South Pacific. I had spent my 16th birthday in Pearl Harbor and sit on top of a load of torpedo warheads. And he pointed out what a trauma that was, because I was a dumb kid. I had a lust for adventure, but I didn't know anything. And I'd never even been to Milwaukee yet, for Christ's sake. And here I was in Pearl Harbor someplace. I thought I was hip because there wasn't a town as big as Eau Claire for a long ways, but there turned out to be some bigger towns. And I remember being on that ship, and that was a great shock. It was the first time in my life I was thrown amongst men. And I was not a man. I was a boy at best, and they were men. And it just was terrible. And I remember, to aggravate it, such things as they always carried a lot of whiskey in their sea bags. There's no beer. No way to keep it cold, I guess. But I could drink beer. I grew up drinking beer because everybody in Wisconsin drinks beer. But I never drank any whiskey. They say, here, Junior, have a drink. Try to be a man. I remember taking a big drink of my first drink of whiskey. And it made me throw up. And they really get, well, Junior, I guess that's a man's drink, isn't it? And Jesus, that was terrible. It's just not enough while everybody else is sitting having a good time to sit in front of your mirror pinching your blackheads and say, boy, this is really living, I'll tell you. And I kept trying to measure up, and I never did measure up, but I know one thing. After I kept trying, every time they drank, I said, give me a drink, and I'd get sick. But once I remember I held a big drink of whiskey down, and for a brief period of time, the transformation began for the first time in my life. I was no longer a pimply-faced boy. For that brief period of time, I felt like a seaman. I felt like a man, not because I'd held it down, but because what it did to me when it was down. For a brief period of time, I was a man amongst men for the first time in my life. And then I got sick and threw up, and I was... Yeah. Take that, sir. Yeah. And from then on, whenever I felt terribly inadequate, if I could do it, I could drink whiskey. And I found ways to drink it so it wouldn't make me sick. But the doctor pointed out to me, he said, you know, your drinking whiskey is really predicated on a trauma that happened to you when you were 15. He said, if you had not run away to sea, you would not have had to overcome this type of problem. And it helped me years later. I remember coming out of the psychiatrist's office having a drink, by a martini, which is not a bad drink when you're sophisticated, and thinking I wasted a lot of years because I had that damn lust for adventure. And it made me feel better to know that it wasn't just nonsense. It was there was something wrong. He pointed out to me such things as, when I was 11 or 12, my parents were divorced. And, you know, I thought, well, that's a trauma. My parents were divorced. And he said that was a trauma, too, but for an entirely different reason than I thought. Now, in my situation, there'd never been a divorce in our family. There had never been a divorce in the Norwegian Lutheran Church that I knew of. There had never been a divorce in our city that I ever heard of. There must have been, but I hadn't heard of it. And my parents, for reasons which I did not understand, I understood later, but I was precocious enough intellectually to understand they were getting divorced well, but I was not emotionally able to understand or to accept it. And I thought that gave me a trauma. The doctor says, no, that isn't it. What happened was, as you tell me later what happened, is what the trauma is this. And he pointed out to me something I hadn't even thought about. Now, I had never seen a divorce before. I had never been around a divorce. But I instinctively acted as though I'd been through 10 of them. Because I was the only child of two guilty parents who felt very bad about this divorce toward me. And without even missing a beat from the age of 11, the day after their divorce, without even knowing how, I immediately began to play them back and forth against each other without any education or training, just naturally a hustler. And from that time on, I never had any discipline that I could not evade. If Mommy got tough, I ran to Daddy and said, Mommy's been saying bad things, Daddy, and I love you, and could I stay with you a while? Of course. And when he got mean, I ran to Mother. Mother, Daddy says that you're not nice and... But I love you, Mother. Could I stay with you? Of course. And when they both got mean, I ran to Grandmother, who hated the whole goddamn outfit. Yeah. And as he pointed out to me, the trauma involved was that the most critical part of my life, 11, 12, 13, 14, I never had any discipline. I did never learn to live within the parameters of a social existence because I could evade it and get out of it. I remember thinking about that as I drank after my psychiatric session that day. If they only would have stuck it out. That was true. I felt better. At least I knew why I had never learned to fit in. Because of that, he pointed other things about how when I was in the third grade, they had some tests and they shoved me ahead of a year and a half in school based on some cockamamie test they took, IQ test or something, reading, I don't know. But they, you know, at that time, that was very unusual in the 30s to put kids ahead a year and a half in school. And they put me into a grade for my reading comprehension, and my mental skill was equal as those around me. Except what they didn't understand at that time, I guess, is that I was a year and a half behind physically. And I was a kid from the third grade from then on. Oh, there's, you take that kid from the third grade. Yeah. I just hated kindergarten recess. I always liked to play ball. I play ball today in my backyard. Play volleyball every Saturday. Just, and I like to play, I pitch softball. I've got an AA softball team and a monkey run. I like sports. But I hated recess from then on because I knew that when they chose up sides, I would always be the last one to be chosen. And I hated it. I hated it. And I always had to show off and make sure they knew I was something. And as the doctor pointed out to me, that began a pattern of overcompensation in my life that I was still doing it in my 30s, of having to do more than you do to prove to you that I'm equal. And as, you know, when I found out about that, it made me feel better, because at least I understood why I kept acting that way sometimes. I think, God damn it. If they'd left me in the third grade, I'd have been a wizard of the third grade instead of that goof in the fifth grade or whatever. And he pointed out, you know, I just went back and all parts of my life. But when I was very little and my parents were in the Depression, my parents were both teachers, and they both had in 1929, when I was very small, there, 1930, they had to take jobs in separate ends of the state to even get a job. And I lived with my grandmother for a year, and the doctor pointed out to me that left a trauma with me, because the very time I needed some reassurance and love from my parents, they had gone away, apparently, to me, and I suffered from it. And I remember thinking of that. Goddamn depression. Because whatever it is, they certainly left me screwed up. The whole thing. And I'll tell you, I always felt better to know why I was the way I was, because at least you're not confused. But there's one thing that happens, and sometimes people don't realize this. And I said it a few minutes ago. After a while, you begin to discover knowing what's wrong with you doesn't help. It just helps you know why you're what's wrong with you. That's all. You can talk about it more clearly, but you know. The best analogy I know to that is being like being on the deck of the Titanic and knowing exactly what just happened. You know. Let me tell you what happened. I've studied this. You people running to the boat, stop and listen. I've triangulated that iceberg, and it's approximately 800,000 tons. We've hit the lower side of it, just sheared it with our port side. We have an aperture in our port side that ranges from 4 inches deep at the prow to about 8 feet deep midships. We are shipping water at the rate of approximately 2,000 gallons a minute. And one day you look around, that's all very interesting, but there you go. That's really wonderful. Everybody else is in a boat, and there you're. And then in 1954, yeah, Jesus. And that's one of the worst self-hypes you can give yourself. You know so much that you think it makes it better, but it doesn't help. In fact, I read that book in 1949, and I read it many times since. It wasn't until after I got sober this time that I finally read in there the same thing that I discovered the hard way. That book clearly says, in this phrase, self-knowledge is not enough. That's why coming to AA and quick getting a lot of self-help books and self-psychology books and insight books, all it does is help you understand why you're going down this time. But let me tell you, and I'm reading a little transubstantial meditation, and I want you to get on. You read Modern Man in Search of His Soul, or Man Against Himself, or read something like very deep, like if you're a depressive, like I used to be a lot. There's a great book called The Decline of the West by a man named Oswald Spengler that is so goddamn depressive that when you get done reading it, you feel up. You just feel up. It's just wonderful. And But I remember standing in that line thinking, God, I come from a fine Christian home. I was raised in a fine, you know. Now, I don't know. You hear a lot of talk from the podium about Catholics being a tough church, and that drove them to alcohol. In Eau Claire, Wisconsin, the Norwegian Lutherans that are weak and can't make it become Catholics. That's the easier, softer way in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And I was raised very, very strongly and straightly. In fact, that's an old kind of, gets to be almost a joke in AA. You stay in AA long enough, you wonder maybe a fine Christian home is a bad place to be raised, because there's so many speakers here who were raised in fine. You never hear anybody say, I was raised in a mafia home and I went to hell. Yeah. All the mafia kids are out making money. But I was raised in a fine Christian home, and I have a good education, and I have a good mind, all the tests tell me. If they paid off on tests, I'd own Nevada, for Christ's sake. You know, I'd own California, and I'd sell Nevada. I don't mean that personally, friends. Let's be good sports to our guests. What the hell am I doing? A suicidal, crazed... And there's... Go back to AA? What do you do there? They say, is your drinking bad, son? Yes, it is. But you should see it when I ain't drinking. But you can't say that, you know. I've often thought, what would people say if you gave them straight answers when you know you're crazy? How are you today? Oh, I have a secret sense of inadequacy. How are you? Yeah. How you been feeling? I've had a sense of impending doom since Tuesday. How are things going at work? I'm afraid. Then they might ask you the worst question of all. What are you afraid of? I don't know. If I knew I was afraid of, I wouldn't be so afraid, I'll tell you that. You know. But if you give people answers like that, you get to be what is known as one of the nudge-em boys, you know. That's when you walk into a room and you watch other people nudge one another. The correct answer is, how are you? Fine, baby. How you going? Swinging. I went back to that AA club the morning that they refused my blood, finally, at the Skid Row Blood Bank. My blood was no longer up to the level of the Skid Row Blood Bank. And I had a feeling I was getting sick. And I went up to that AA club, and it was early in the morning, and I slept in an abandoned car in the morning, out in the back seat of an abandoned car, and... When the club opened, I went to that manager guy named Sullivan. I said, Sullivan, I'm dying, for Christ's sake. I've had a little slip, but I want to do better, and I want to work those steps. And I went through my whole song of the... But I couldn't carry it off anymore. I was so rotten, I couldn't even carry it off. And he just looked at me, that look I've been getting all my life. Maybe you have too. People who know you're lying. And there's nothing to do but keep lying. It's just terrible. And they know you're lying. I've got it from presidents of advertising agencies, and I've got it from guys in Skid Row missions. That same look. Jesus, I don't believe you. And But finally he said, I'm sick of your nonsense. He says, get in the back room back there. Shut the door. I don't want anybody to know you're in here. I don't want you around my doorway. And I remember walking in thinking, didn't I outsmart that dumb son of a bitch? And I walked to the back room, and there was a sofa there, and I laid down it and threw up a little bit and caught my strength and thought, I've got to hustle somebody in this club to get out of this town. I'm going to die. This is a bad town. Bad town, bad thing, but Seattle will be all right if I can just get there before I die. And I went through the people I'd met in AA around there to see who would have enough money I could hustle, who I could lie to, who I could cheat. And much to my surprise, I never had another drink till this day. And now it's almost 15 years since that morning. And I haven't had a drink. And I haven't had any medication of any kind stronger than an aspirin. And I suppose I was as sick as most people who come to AA. And I haven't smoked any marijuana. And I haven't had any narcotics in my system. And I haven't had any professional help. And here I am today, come here today at tremendous expense and no little inconvenience, so I can talk to you newer people and just say, why can't you be sincere the way we were in the old days? I'm kind of a funny feeling. I'm starting to feel sometimes like a junior old-timer sometimes. God knows I don't like old-timers. I don't know what I'll do now. I heard a guy say in Alabama a couple years ago, he says, I need a couple more things to be a real old-timer. He says, I need a little more silver in my temples. I need a bad case of hemorrhoids. He says, the silver at my temples will make me look distinguished, and the hemorrhoids will give me the proper note of grave concern. Well, I don't think that's essential. But I want you to know this. The reason I went through all that long story, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I like to hear it, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I prefer to live with my image of being off the silver bird come to help you. I shouldn't use that word help me, because I associate that. That's what they used to say they put on the shock treatment electrodes. We're going to help you. Go help somebody else, you big redneck son of a bitch. Well, but I find myself, as I say, in the strange position today of being sober at least a few years. Not as much as some of you, but more than most of you, I would say. And active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and founder of AA groups, and I don't run them anymore. I just sit in the back and point out to the secretary what he's doing wrong. I don't. In fact, my home group next Tuesday night is at Ohio Street. It's going to celebrate its 10th anniversary. And some of the people here were at that first meeting when there were 6 people there. And there hasn't been an empty seat in that meeting now in 9 years. 50 people stand in the back, or 75 every week. A fellow just told me tonight, he'd been there a couple weeks ago, and one of the 75 standing in the back. You can't get in the goddamn place. And it isn't because it's of me, it's because it's an enthusiastic AA group, because there's been a lot of secretaries since me. One of the ex-secretaries is sitting next to me down here. And I've sponsored a lot of people. And I've turned over my home to people. And I have done everything I can do. And I've been, sometimes I think I've really done so much for that goddamn AA. Maybe I should become a philosopher. Maybe I should become a philosopher. But the whole point is this. The reason I talk about that story is this. To help remind me that whether you like it or accept it or not, it is my opinion that Alcoholics Anonymous will allow you to live comfortably in the world wherever you come from if you practice its principles. And I don't mean practice them permanently and perfectly, because no matter what you hear from these podiums, nobody practices them perfectly. There are no perfect people in AA. One of the things that used to hold me at arm's length was that I used to think, well, if I got to be perfect like that speaker, I could do it too, but I'm ripped up. But there are no perfect people here. One of the greatest phrases at all, the only thing in AA outside of the steps that I've memorized, I used to memorize a lot of things and use them for debates, and I kept getting drunk a lot, too. But one of the things that I like to remember, because sometimes I think to myself, my God, I've been working, when am I going to get well? Be perfect like the real A's. And there's a great thing that was read tonight by Gwen from Fallon, Nevada. Once upon a time, I was in the Naval Air Station Psych Ward in Fallon, Nevada. How does that make you feel? Anyway, series of misunderstandings. They flew me to Alameda right away when they realized I was too tough for Nevada. He read tonight, you know, and it's something we hardly ever hear. We hear the steps, we hear the thing, but there's a great reassurance if you feel still imperfect. And it comes right after 12 steps. It says, do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. And I would tell you based on my experience, that many, many people I've known in AA, you feel good through progress, no matter where you start. That's why you never get to any place that is going to be all right. As you progress, you feel better. If you don't progress, you feel bad. Then you progress and you feel better. And what makes people progress? Pain. Pain is a great motivator. I don't know anybody who is motivated by comfort. God, it's just so wonderful. I think I'll work a step. So after you are sober, you start feeling pain, you think this is unnatural. That's natural. But the one thing, I've had to change almost everything I believe about AA, except one thing. And I'll tell you what that one thing is. In 1949, I thought that my problem was not alcohol. In 1973, I believe my problem is not alcohol, primarily now because Alcoholics Anonymous spells out that my problem is not alcohol. There's a difference between having a problem with alcohol and what we got. If you got a problem with alcohol, you're wasting your time at these kind of meetings. Just quit. Shape up. Be a man. Or a woman, or... yeah, be whatever you are. Better. Sometimes you get the impression, as I used to, real alcoholics are people who stay drunk all the time. But I'll tell you something. That isn't an alcoholic, because no human body can stay drunk all the time. I didn't know that till I was sober a couple of years and working in the medical corporation. I ran across that startling fact that no human body can stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights. It is impossible. Your body makes you get sober. Part of your body makes you drink more, and the other rest of it makes you stop after a while. And it's a life-saving defense mechanism. A lot of people don't recognize it. But let me tell you in one sentence what happens. Your body, when sufficiently toxified through alcohol or any other chemical inside of it, if it sets up a series of conditioned, involuntary, physiological reflexes to reduce toxicity through the induction of reverse peristalsis. Some circles, also known as puking. I'll bet there are very few people here who haven't watched their body induce a little reverse peristalsis. I'm sure a number of us have knelt in front of the old porcelain altar at morning vespers and gazed into those shimmering waters and say your daily prayer, oh, God. Some days, I'm almost done. How much tape you got left, Slim? Some days when you get terribly sick, your body will remove toxicity from both ends at once. Not only are you sick, but you got to make a series of absolutely correct decisions. They got to be just like that. Your body will make you pass out. Your body will make you sweat it out. But I'll guarantee you one thing. If you got a problem with alcohol, you got no real problem. All you have to do is quit and you're home free. The problem we seem to have is it sounds the same almost, but it's so much different that it makes it lethal. It's not alcohol, it's something called alcoholism. And the difference is, if you got a problem with alcohol, you quit alcohol, your problem is over. In alcoholism, you merely move into a sober part of your problem. until you drink, and then you move in the drinking part of your problem. And then you move into the sober part of your problem. And when you're sober from alcohol, you're just as sick as you were when you were drunk. Because the lethal part of alcoholism is not that you can't get the patient sober, but that eventually sobriety will become sufficiently untenable to have to begin drinking next time again. Or taking pills. Or smoking marijuana. Or doing something that will chemically ease the pressures, because sobriety becomes intolerable. And it can be as president of the world's largest insurance corporation, a man I know in AA, or it couldn't be as an out-of-work dishwasher in Venice, man I know. When it gets bad enough, you got to take it. That means you get a $500 suit on or a 10-cent T-shirt. When the hole gets in your stomach and the wind blows through, it doesn't make any difference what kind of clothes you got on, baby. It really smarts. And I want to remember that fact, because that's something that I think most hardly any alcoholics in the street know, and half the people in AA, if they're like me, never knew. That the purpose of AA is not to help you beat drinking. The purpose of AA is to help you beat sobriety. Because that's where we got to fight the battle. There are no drunken AAs, because AA has nothing to do with drinking. There's no step that discusses how to quit drinking. In this book, there is not one paragraph that discusses how to get sober. Not one. And yet, a lot of us almost die thinking, if I get sober, it'll be all right. If you get sober, you have a chance to begin to learn to live in sobriety. Perhaps if you're like me, to have to get a tough sponsor who will not take your crap, who will not adjust to you and tell you you're wonderful, who will make you to do the things that I had to do finally. But the ultimate purpose of AA is not to be the most profound or witty or outstanding member of your group or your area, or to learn pretty words to say that'll kill you because you say them so well you don't have to do them. It's to little by little find out what you have to do outside that door. And maybe you have to make nightly pit stops back here. I did for years. I went to a meeting almost every night. But little by little, I learned to live out there. Not fast. When I was 11 months sober, I was still living in the same abandoned car I was living in the first day I was sober. I didn't have any front teeth. I could not hold a job. I'd lost a job as a dishwasher, as a busboy, as a janitor, as a furniture mover. I never held a job more than 3 days in my first year of sobriety. And I was starving to death. And the odd thing was that my sponsor had made me do some things. Like the day I was going to commit suicide, he took advantage of my pain and made me write an inventory for the first time that I knew intellectually could not help me. But after taking that inventory, something funny happened in my life. I had a new guy sleeping in the front seat of the abandoned car that I was living in the back seat in. Now, there are still old timers who say, you're a crazy little son of a bitch that had that guy in the front seat of that car out there, aren't you? The guy never made it. He died. But I made it. And my sponsor pointed out, that's the purpose of helping people, so that you make it. Not nice if they make it. But every step here that looks to be some abstract therapy and do-gooderism is not to help anybody except yourself. That's why it's called a selfish program. We are not here to become altruistic. We are here to learn some new conditioning of emotional things so that what happens? So that no matter what happens, I have an alternative to drinking to stand it. Now, I got a very, very, you know, I could spend my whole time, I'm done now, this is my last sentence with a couple commas. I could have given you my whole story tonight on the wonderful things that have had happen to me. When I was 5 years sober, the same old wife and same old kids moved to California, had another little kid. Every time we reconciled, it just really wonderful for a while. Did you throw that glass? Instinctively, I can lay blame on somebody. I have a my oldest daughter, who was a psychological wreck at 9 and could not speak because of the intolerable condition that she lived in, now is have been able to stop her for years. She is the mother of a little girl 5 years old who looks just the way she looked when she was little. And now I'm adopting my grandfatherly pose sometimes. I'm thinking of getting a pipe and a black shawl and to rock a little bit. It's going to be a scorcher tomorrow. Next week or the week after, for sure, I'm going to do that. As soon as I lose 2 more games of softball. My second oldest daughter, who was just hostile and vicious sometime when she was little and just couldn't fit in, I'm very proud of her. She just finished her degree in sociology at Long Beach State and has entered a convent in Northern California so she can go to China and teach little Chinese kids. She's going to become a nun. That's very hard for Lutheran to see that happen in their family. I made a bad marriage, though. I married a Catholic. It's a funny thing. I always hated Catholics. I was conditioned to, and now some of my best friends are priests. Now, isn't that an amazing thing? Some of my best friends are priests. Of course, I wouldn't want my daughter to marry one. My third oldest daughter, who was screwed up, is studying to be a doctor at UCLA. Fourth oldest one is still home, studying to be a juvenile delinquent, as far as I can make out. I have a little boy who just had the longest home run in Little League last Saturday, and I'm so proud. My father, who didn't talk to me for 10 years, the last thing my father said to me for 10 years was the day he came to the jail cell in 1950 and said, "Did you have a good time last night, son?" I said, "No, I got drunk. I'm going to do better, Dad." He says, "I hope you had a good time, because while you were drunk, your little son died, and he wouldn't have died if you'd have been home." And he never wanted to see me again. And I never... My mother... She would send me a Bible verse, but she always cried when she saw me, so I stayed away from her. And I never was anywhere that anybody wanted me. And I never knew why. And it's a funny thing. I'm very close to my father. 2 weeks ago, as I say, I flew into Wisconsin just to take my mother to the Lutheran church on Mother's Day. I just felt like doing it. We're very close. And nice family, and I'm not an out-of-work dishwasher today. I have a pretty good job, and I can order non-alcoholics around. Okay, you mermy, shape up. This is your last chance. If you don't become alcoholic, you're out. I own a home. That's a hard thing for a floater. I'm a natural-born floater. I don't like to own anything, because when the town gets hot, I just want to tell the landlord, "We're leaving on the first, Slim, and I'll go now to find a place." Now I'm in a house I'm going to be in until 1998. And sometime that wind blows across the park and it says, "Clancy, looking good in Seattle." All this is very nice. It makes a nice story, and it's touching to say I've got a home and a family, and my family's close. It's all just wonderful. But I'll tell you something. I had nearly all of these things the day I committed suicide in El Paso. I had all of these things the day I started hitchhiking in a blizzard across to the West Coast. I had these things a lot. And by themselves, they're not enough. The greatest gift, and the reason I suggest to you, if you're new or about to graduate, which is an equally untenable place, or when you've become the guru of your entire area and no longer need take action because you've gotten a franchise for God in your block, I suggest that you and I all remember this is a program of living, not explanation. This is a program of applying it in the world, not of explaining prettily why you don't. I'm not hiding and obfuscating behind a wall of words, because the greatest gift I have gotten out of AA, and I'm sure you might understand this, and I think it's there for everybody in this room if they want it and are willing to do it. The greatest gift I have is this. In a few minutes, I'm going to walk out that door, somehow, some way, through the attempting and a feeble and poor way to apply the therapies of Alcoholics Anonymous to my life, and trying to force myself to take the actions, even when I, at the moments, I don't necessarily believe them sometimes, when I'm feeling bad or depressed. But to keep doing them, what has enabled me to do is to walk out that door tonight and feel I'm on a street that I belong on. And I don't have to be afraid tonight. And I don't have to feel that I don't fit in. A feeling of, lifelong feeling of mine. It isn't all gone now, but it's gone most of the time. A feeling of not belonging. The best gift I can tell you, the reason for doing all of these things and going to these meetings and taking those steps and letting your sponsor give you some goddamn guidance once in a while without debate and taking these actions is so that you and I can walk out in the world by God with a sense of self-worthiness that enables us to walk straight down the street and say, I belong to be here. Through Alcoholics Anonymous, a concept of a power greater than myself that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and through people such as yourself, I thank you for that street outside that door. Thank you.